I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. The year was 1961. The Yale Psychology Department placed this ad: subjects needed for a memory test. Pay $4 an hour. The volunteer would come to Dr. Stanley Milgram's lab, and there was introduced to another test subject, whom he helped to strap into something that looked like an electric chair. The volunteer was told he would be testing his partner's memory of word pairs and was asked to administer electric shocks when the man got them wrong. In the end, 65% of Milgram's subjects followed the orders of the man in the white lab coat, choosing to administer shocks even when the subject in the chair screamed in pain and begged to stop. Some say Stanley Milgram's obedience to authority experiment may have been the most important psychological test ever devised. It showed that given the right circumstances, middle-class Americans could indulge in cruelty imaginable only during the stress of wartime. Connection listeners, what did Milgram's experiment teach us about human behavior? That deep down we are, to use Daniel Goldhagen's phrase, willing executioners? Or did we learn simply that average Americans listen to men in lab coats? A narrow lesson that's a far cry from generalizing about our inhumanity to fellow human beings. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Our phone number is 1-800-TALK. Here with me in the studio to discuss Stanley Milgram's famous study on obedience to authority is Lauren Slater, psychologist and author of the upcoming book, Opening Skinner's Box, Great Psychological Experiments of the 20th Century. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
Also joining me from the NPR affiliate studios at WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, is Dr. Thomas Blass, professor of psychology at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County and author of the upcoming biography, The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. Both Slater's and Blass's books are due out in March. Before we hear from them, we're going to hear from Dr. Alan Elms. He's a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. He was also Stanley Milgram's research assistant during the study and watched the experiment with Milgram from behind the glass. I spoke to him earlier and asked him what the experimental setup at the lab looked like.
The laboratory had a table with the shock generator on it. The shock generator was a machine that Stanley had specially built to his specifications, sort of like a large sound mixing machine with 30 switches on it, marked from 15 volts to 450 volts, with labels on the last several switches saying danger, severe shock, and sort of things sort of like that. There was another table with some recording devices on it, a tape recorder and something called an Esterline Angus event recorder, which registered whenever one of the shock levers was thrown and for how long it was thrown.
What was that chair like that the sort of actor sat in?
It was just a simple metal chair with metal arms. The victim, the actor, his arms were strapped down to the arms of the chair with, I think, leather straps. And electrodes were placed on his arm. Electrode paste was used to ensure a good electrical contact, as the real subject was told. The experimenter said that no permanent harm would come to the person who was going to be receiving these electric shocks.
What were the most startling reactions that the actual subjects of the experiment generated?
There were two kinds of most startling reactions. One was that some people became so involved and so distressed that they began crying at times while they were still pushing down the shock levers. The other, and we felt even more startling reaction, was that some people began laughing, went into long laughing jags again as they continued pushing down the levers. It seemed to be really out of control of their own responses.
How do you explain the laughing response?
Well, we felt that it was an expression of nervous tension. We didn't feel that these people were really enjoying themselves, and when they were interviewed later, they generally expressed embarrassment about their laughter. they were reacting as the people who were crying were reacting in an emotional way.
Dr. Elms, as a young researcher at the time, did you find the results of the study as a whole startling or surprising?
Oh, yes. I was quite startled, I think I can say, and Stanley Milgram was as well. He did not expect nearly as much obedience to the commands of the authority figure as he actually got.
Dr. Elms, thank you for your time.
All right. Bye.
That was Dr. Alan Elms, a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. He was Stanley Milgram's research assistant for the famous experiment that we're discussing. Lauren Slater, what did Stanley Milgram set out to test or discover when he designed this experiment?
Well, he wanted to test obedience, and he wanted to test it in a graphic, illuminating kind of way. He was really influenced by a prior experiment, Solomon Asch's test of perceptual conformity. But he wanted to take it to another level. He wanted to, this was, Solomon Asch had tested conformity to lines, if you, how likely you were to see a line of a certain length based on what the group had to say. Milgram wasn't happy with that. He wanted a big bang experiment. And so he got the idea that he could test people's obedience to authority. And the way he did that was to set up this sham situation.
Was it unprecedented in a sense? Can you tell us a little even more about the mechanics that both the volunteer and the subject were thrust into?
Well, yes. What he did is he had basically, I mean, he varied the conditions, but let's say the general condition that he used, or the most prevalent one, was there's two rooms. And the learner would go into one room, but this learner was really an actor. And the teacher, who was the person who was going to be delivering the shocks, would go into another room. And the teacher, who was the naive subject, would read word pairs, say lake, loon, sun, cloud. And the learner was supposed to remember the word pairs. Anytime the learner forgot, he would receive a sham shock. But the teacher thought these shocks were real. And Milgram actually had scripts written up for his learner, so that the learner around 150 volts would start moaning. And then at 300 volts, if you look in the archives, he might start saying, Milgram had scripts written up, ow, stop. And then, you know, at 325, he says he has a heart condition. And the point was, how far up the shock board would the naive subject go based on instructions from the experimenter, who kept saying, continue along.
Was there ever, this is like a leading question because I think I know the answer.
Okay.
Was there ever a modification that he made to the experiment to maybe put the volunteer in a position of empathy, exact more empathy?
Well, actually, that's a crucial part of the experiment, actually, that people sometimes forget. He did vary the conditions. He was appalled, actually, that people could hear other people's screams and continue to administer shocks under orders. So what he did is he took away the wall, so to speak, so now you could see the learner. And would that make people less compliant? Or he actually put the learner and the teacher in the same room and forced the learner, if the learner made a mistake, the teacher had to force the hand onto a switch plate. And he wondered, well, if you actually have to touch your victim, will you, in fact, obey authority? And he found that 30% of people, even in that condition, slamming the learner's hand onto the switch plate, while the learner screamed in pain, 30% of people would do that.
Professor Blass, you've been working on a lengthy biography mm-hmm. of Dr. Milgram. In the context of the time, what were the concrete results of the experiment, and how were they received?
Well, the reception was mixed. I think many people just found it very interesting, troubling, surprising. Certainly, as the others have mentioned, nobody expected it. Milgram himself didn't expect it. In fact, he writes that he would have been just as happy to find less obedience, because a subsidiary or maybe even a main, similar, an aim of equal importance to identifying the extremes of obedience was to see how obedience is responsive to various situational factors. And And so that, in fact, he, in one of his writings, he says, my aim was not to test the extremes of obedience. Only real life can do that. And he would have been just as happy, although probably not as famous, if he had found that most people defied authority. Because as Lauren just pointed out, there are actually a number of different variations, which itself carries a very important message. She was referring to what's called the four-part proximity series, where Milgram varied the distance, both emotional and physical, between the teacher and the learner, all the way from, at one extreme, just hearing knocks on the wall from the victim, no voice feedback, then distance being reduced by introducing pre-recorded voice feedback of increasing pitifulness and intensity, and then bringing the learner and the teacher into the same room, where now you have both visual cues and you see the victim writhing in pain besides the expressing the scripted lines. And then finally, the condition that Lauren mentioned is the final one, where essentially the distance was reduced to zero in order for the learner to, the rules were changed slightly, the rules were changed such that in order for the learner to get shocked at 100, instead of receiving through the electrodes through the supposedly in the armchair, the teacher actually had to actively place the learner's hand onto the shock plate for him to get shocked. At 150 volts, he refuses to do that. And so he's instructed by the experimenter, well, obviously you're going to place his hand down on the shock plate. And what you get and what you got was occasionally the teacher wrestling the learner onto the, you know, to have him make contact with the shock plate. So in terms of reactions, varied reactions, I think I think it was a revelatory finding for everybody, including Milgram, and but many people, well, as I say, some people were bothered by the ethics of it, and of course that is one of the things that has come down to us as one of the legacy, the whole ethical controversy and the various institutionalizations of protection of human subjects that we have today is at least partially due to the uproar created by Milgram.
I'm going to ask Lauren briefly, we're moving to a brief break, but we want to address this issue of the utterly controversial nature and I guess the impact on Dr. Milgram's career in the immediate aftermath. Can you just sketch us briefly what happened to Milgram?
Well, the briefest way to say it is that he didn't get any tenure track position after that. He wound up with a job at Queens City College of New York, and his application for the American Psychological Association was held up for a year while he was investigated. So, I mean, it put, ironically, it was the greatest thing he ever did in his career, and it also put the biggest dent in his career at the same time.
We'll get back to that. Thank you. Connection listeners, we're discussing Stanley Milgram's famous obedience to authority experiments that took place in 1961. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our question for this hour is the extent of obedience. What do you think the limits are of the so-called average person and his or her tolerance for inflicting, not receiving, but inflicting pain on a fellow citizen? You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR.
I'm sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This hour we're discussing Dr. Stanley Milgram's famous obedience to authority experiments that took place in 1961 down at Yale. And my guests are Lauren Slater, a psychologist and author of the forthcoming book Opening Skinner's Box that has a chapter in it essentially revisiting the famous Milgram experiments. Also on the line from us, with us from Maryland, is Dr. Thomas Blass, who has a biography of Stanley Milgram coming out in March. Dr. Blass, it's impossible to read your personal biography without noticing that your family saved you from the Holocaust in Central Europe, and obviously Milgram's experiment in 1961, we're only 16 or 17 years removed from the events of World War II. What were those, in a sense, necessarily interpreted or equated with the genocide of the Holocaust?
Were Milgram's experiments equated?
Well, the idea that, so-called average people would quite literally torture other so-called average people.
Well, I don't think that I don't think that was the mainstream view. In fact, that was one of the innovative contribution of Milgram is to point to the fact that you don't have to be a sadist or vicious to act in ways that are reprehensible. That given a certain kind of relationship between an individual and authority, if an authority that you consider to have certain legitimacy, that is, he or she has the right to prescribe your behavior, you have an obligation to carry out his or her wishes. Under those circumstances, one's moral sense can be overridden by the authority's commands. So the mainstream position was, in fact, the earliest psychologists to get involved in this were to see the whole process, what happened in Nazi Germany, a product of the of leaders who were pathological. And that was really a hard case to make because various tests of psychological tests did not really show that consistently. What Milgram did was to really go beyond conjecture, go beyond intelligent speculation, and apply the experimental method to a question of profound importance. And what that did was to do two things. Number one, it by using an experiment or kind of an analog, he was able to take something that was controversial, was always hard to discuss dispassionately for good reason, and move it into the realm of perhaps a more objective basis for discourse. Secondly, by doing an experiment and doing it in the United States, it became more difficult for us to disengage ourselves from the implications of those findings. But if I just may, for one second, go back to one comment on Lauren that she made earlier, I think she has too pessimistic a take on Milgram's future. He did not get tenure at Harvard. However, he spent most of his career from 1967 on at CUNY, City University of New York, graduate center where he was offered the chairmanship of the social psychology program, and he was there to the end of his life, and he had a fairly productive, very productive rest of his career. Of course, the obedience work overshadowed virtually everything else, but he had a chance to express his creativity in that context, and he did. He had tenure. Not only did he have tenure there, but he was the chairman of the program.
Lauren, in your book, you also address and discuss the either applicability or non-applicability of a sort of the Holocaust model. Again, you know, Goldhagen gave us some words to talk about it. This idea of so-called normal people engaging in unspeakable acts. What's your take on this vis-a-vis Milgram?
Well, I mean, I've talked to people in running the chapter, I've talked to people who said Milgram directly wanted to understand the Holocaust, and other people who have said that he wanted to, he was somewhat of a kind of leprechaun or somewhat of he was dramatic and he wanted to set up this dramatic experiment, and in fact, the Holocaust, the applicability to the Holocaust came after the fact. But whether it came before or after the fact doesn't change the view that he set up a very, very powerful experiment, a powerful situation that left us with more questions about why people commit violence, and that can't be denied.
Connection listeners, we're discussing the famous obedience to authority experiments of Dr. Stanley Milgram. You can join our conversation by phoning 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Jack is joining us from Durham, North Carolina.
Hi, Alex. During your opening, I found myself wondering what's known about the 35% of participants who refused to continue and what perhaps has been concluded from their experience.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Lauren, how would you answer that?
Well, that was my question. What about the naysayers, the 30-35% who didn't agree to go along with this experiment or didn't? And what I set out to do was to find someone who I set out to find someone who had been a defiant subject, and in an attempt to understand, you know, what was their defiance based in? Was it what were the variables that allowed them to disobey orders? There's been very little work done on trying to understand the individual personality variables of the subjects, because Milgram's paradigm was a social psychology paradigm, where he was really looking at groups of people and how the aggregate behaves. And he really believed that it had nothing to do, or he thought it probably had nothing to do with individual character traits, but more how people react when they're in a very, very persuasive situation. So a lot of people would say there's really nothing that you can find that's of any great significance of the 30 to 35% who disobeyed. Maybe they just had coffee that morning and, you know, felt irritable and got up sooner. I think it's a great question, though. I think that there probably are some stable personality variables in those people, but I don't know what they are.
But you actually found a man who was a defiant subject, right?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about him and his decision?
Well, I found a man who was a defiant subject, and I was really excited when I found him, because I was doing a lot of searching, and I did expect, perhaps naively, that I was going to meet a man who was going to sort of tell me something about the heart of morality or the heart of independent or autonomous thinking. And what I found was he's a very, very delightful character. And he so clearly remembers the experiments, which point to their power. He also did not seem particularly defiant to me, and at this point he was you know, well into his 70s, and I was surprised to see that he had lived his life in a pretty conventional manner. So that he worked for Exxon, he was, you know, a compliant soldier in the army. So the defiance that he showed in the lab did not translate over into a defiant lifestyle. And so then you get into all these questions of, how valid is this experiment? Is it really measuring obedience or disobedience?
We're going to take a call from Auburn, Massachusetts. Virginia is joining us. Hi, Virginia.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for both of your guests pertaining to perhaps a grander society at large relationship. I'm wondering if either one of your guests see a relationship between the percentage of so-called average Americans who participated in this experiment and followed the instructions, sort of a reflection of the society at that time, and whether that may have changed now in our post-9/11 era, where today perhaps a different percentage of Americans, you know, on the average, would refuse to comply or would comply.
Thank you, Virginia. What do you think of that, Dr. Blass?
Well, I actually have some data on that up to a certain point. One of the things I did was to correlate. I tried to find all the replications of Milgram's obedience experiment. And the last one I could find was conducted in 1985, and that was in Austria, because in the United States, the ethical rules shut down the obedience experiment in about 1974. But anyway, I ran a correlation between when a study was done and the amount of obedience it yielded. And this spanned, let's say, a 25-year time span. And I found absolutely no relationship. There were variations, you know, between replications between experiments. But that variation was not related to time, change over time. My guess would be, I think there's certain universals in social behavior, and based on that, as I say, they went up to 85. Did 9/11 change things? I personally don't think so. I think there's certain constancies in human nature that override specific events. They may find their expression differently, but I think society always will have to have a hierarchical relationship. We could not exist without a power structure. The question is, what is the nature of that power structure? Milgram focused on what he called legitimate authority. He wasn't looking at, you know, somebody complying at the, you know, at the end of a gun. That's fairly obvious. What is not obvious, and what was revelatory about his finding, is that somebody who absolutely had no power, no means of enforcing his commands, but had the legitimacy, that is, the subject saw him as having the right, by virtue of his status, by virtue of his role, to prescribe behavior, that role relationship was able to override decades of training and morality and conscience and so on and so forth. So that I have data up to through 85, which shows no relationship, and there were many events one could point to.
I can ask Virginia how she's reacting to what you're saying. What do you think, Virginia?
Well, actually, it prompts another question. If you're relating the whole set of experiments to predicting or, you know, examining human nature versus, you know, nature that's created by society, if you're looking at basic human nature and basic human tendencies and responses to authority figures, then perhaps the interplay of certain levels of moral reasoning might come into play. I'm wondering if I recently just completed a course in psychology that covered the six stages of moral reasoning, according to Kohlberg, and I'm wondering if certain people, even though they may not have been aware of it, had attained certain levels of moral reasoning that enabled them to, rather than just following the rules and following an authority, said, no, this is not right, I'm going to stop.
I think that's a great question. I mean, I don't know whether or not if you took the 35% naysayers and ranked them on Kohlberg stages of moral development, if you wouldn't find that they were higher. According to just some preliminary research that Alan Elms and Stanley Milgram did, where they were looking for independent personality variables, they didn't find anything consistent. But the question really hangs. I mean, the earlier caller's question really, this is all gets back to the earlier caller. I mean, how do we explain it? 35% is not an insignificant amount. It's not like 98% obeyed and 2% didn't. And so we can make these general comments about how people act in situations. 65% obeyed, and that's very troubling. But what about those 35%? How do we explain them? Social psychology attempts to explain the Milgram experiments by saying it was the situation, but everybody was in the same situation and not everybody reacted the same way.
You write in your book that more than once, by the way, that you're convinced that you would have been a rule obeyer in this context.
Yes, I'm very obedient in general in my life. And I also know, I feel like if you read Milgram's book or learn about the experiments, there's kind of an eerie recognizability that goes on, at least for me, and I think for many, for 65% of us at least, where you remember there's been times when you have allowed your own perceptions to... you haven't hung on to your own perceptions. You've allowed them to be overridden by what an authority says. I mean, all sorts of even tiny ways we do that. If we're walking down the street and we see a homeless person, we know what the right thing to do is. The right thing is to reach out, but there's some reason why we don't. That's not exactly analogous to authority. But again, there's all kinds of times where we know what's right, but we can't act on it.
We're going to take a call from Spokane, Washington. Dan is joining us on the line. Dan, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I heard your program first thing this morning, and I looked at my next-door neighbor sitting in the chair in our living room and thought to myself, I wonder which one of us would be more likely to have complied with the instructions to zap the poor soul in the chair in the next room.
Yes, Dan, and so what was the answer?
And then I thought to myself, well, huh. Of course, I thought I would have been much less likely. But then I thought, well, you know what would be... I was in the military myself in the late 60s, went through boot camp, and I can remember coming out of boot camp and being afraid to appear outdoors in public without my uniform cap on. Because we were told when we were let out, you know, that now be sure when you leave for Christmas vacation that you're in full uniform and don't go outside without your hat and so forth. And I thought, my God, if I were asked today to participate in Milgram's experiment as the teacher, I think it's a I'm quite sure of how I would respond. Of course, you don't know, but if I were asked to participate at age 20 in the Milgram experiment, I think I probably would have zapped the poor fools. And so I'm wondering what kind of age range people were that were in this experiment. I would trust that surely that information was kept and filed.
Dr. Blass, what's the answer there?
The answer was that the age range was 20 to 50, and I don't believe there was any, or at least I have not seen any data from Milgram where he found the relationship between age and obedience. I think the, but to get back, you know, I mean, the general question we're talking about is individual differences, and clearly that is a lingering puzzle. Milgram himself clearly did emphasize situational factors, and but he didn't ignore. He actually, there's a statement in his book saying, I'm sure there's a personality basis to obedience and defiance, but I'm also sure that we haven't found it. So, but as a tactic, social psychology does, in fact, focus on situational factors, and I think that's its major contribution, because usually we feel that behavior flows from within, which is why the obedience experiment is so surprising. In fact, people, when they were asked to predict, well, you know, they were given the description by Milgram about the scenario, asked to predict how many people would go to the top of the chalkboard, the predictions got were way off the mark, including a group of
Dr. Blass, I'm sorry, we have to pause briefly. We're going to come back in a few minutes. Connection listeners, we're discussing Stanley Milgram's famous obedience to authority experiments. Connection listeners, how do you think the results might be different today from what they were in 1961? You can reach our show by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this.
I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're spending this hour discussing the famous obedience to authority experiments of Dr. Stanley Milgram that took place at Yale in 1961. Milgram rather famously got average Americans to administer what looked like a lethal electroshocks to a man on the street who was in fact a paid actor to feign various levels of agony. Our guests are Dr. Thomas Blass is on the line with us from Maryland. He's a professor of psychology and also the author of a forthcoming biography of Stanley Milgram called The Man Who Shocked the World. In the studio with me is Lauren Slater, a psychologist and writer who's devoted a chapter to Stanley Milgram in her forthcoming book called Opening Skinner's Box, Great Psychological Experiments of the 20th Century. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Doug is joining us from Marlborough, Massachusetts.
How you doing?
Great.
Thanks for having me on the show. I have a quick question. It seems like it was pretty shocking, I guess, the results that were found, but Milgram, I guess, was questioned about his ethics, and these kinds of experiments have been halted, I think somebody said, since 84, 85, and I'm questioning what is the ethical question? What is the problem there? And, you know, there's a lot we haven't learned. How come we can't carry on and try and learn a little bit more about this?
Well, that's a good question. Well, we can start by saying that Milgram did not get informed consent from his subjects. So they understood they were participating in one kind of experiment when, in fact, they were participating in another kind of experiment, and when they found out what they were participating in, that it was not about learning, it was not a test of learning, but it was a test of obedience, it could be extremely upsetting to people who suddenly were given this knowledge about themselves that they were sadists, essentially, and they were given this knowledge about themselves without ever asking for that knowledge, and that's an ethical problem. The other problem actually is one Milgram may have said to that. I mean, if he were here with us, he may say, "But I debriefed all my subjects afterwards. I made sure no one was psychotic. I made sure that no one, you know, went home in tears or whatever." But you can't ever really debrief a subject from an experiment like that because you've given them a knowledge that they may not have wanted about themselves. It's going to last them a lifetime. And so it does all come down to informed consent and what you are or allowed not to do with human subjects. Whether or not that's sanitized, those ethical guidelines may in fact have sanitized psychological experimentation to the point where it's just no fun anymore, and where we can't really do the in-depth, shocking experiments that lead to the kind of real, vibrant knowledge that we want. I'm not sure that that's the case, but I sometimes wonder if it isn't.
Dr. Blass, what has been, in a sense, the fallout in that one area where I guess you can't, what's the correct term? You can't have psychological subjects experience stress or unpleasant feelings. Has that affected the profession?
Well, I'm sorry, is that what?
Has that affected the profession?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, let me just modify that a little bit. It's not an absolute. I mean, it is the case that there are regulations in place which have made it much more difficult, if not impossible, to do an experiment like Milgram's or even more benign ones. And Milgram himself was operating in an ethical vacuum. There were really no guidelines then. He may have pushed the proverbial envelope a bit, but there were experiments with inducing high degrees of stress and similarly problematic experiments at that time. But clearly today, in theory, that is, informed consent is a centrally important feature of today's guidelines. However, it's not an absolute. One could, in theory, make a case via what's called the cost-benefit analysis that a particular experiment, despite the fact that it may cause discomfort for subjects, the benefits to him, to the subject or society could outweigh that. But an IRB, so-called IRB, an institution review board, which is mandated by the federal government, has to make that decision. So to answer your question, it has had a dampening effect. The fact that we have these IRBs who, in fact, sometimes go beyond, really, they're overzealous in the application of the principles to the fact that even the benign experiments often cannot be done because they're just overreacting. These RLBs are just making even routine experiments sometimes difficult, and discourages people.
We're going to take a call from Barbara, who's trying to reach us from Connecticut.
Hi.
I'm
calling because I find it interesting that experiment. I've been using that over the last 15 years with my students. I teach psychology in Boston, and I find that the one thing that doesn't change in their responses around the experiment is that these students still think that there is a relationship between the subject's confidence level and whether or not they pulled the levers and actually administered what they thought were shocks.
Is that correct?
Well, I don't understand what you mean when you say their confidence level.
But the I've been listening to the show, and yes, they ask questions about ethics. Yes, they ask questions about, you know, obedience. They ask questions about the context and the situational factors. But I find that our students are more sophisticated over the last 15 years. The one thing that hasn't changed is that they remain consistent in saying that they think that the subject's confidence levels, those individuals that are playing the teacher sitting at the terminals, they think that confidence of that individual has something to do with whether or not they actually pulled the levers.
You mean just like general life confidence about yourself in the world?
Well, our ego structure, the health of the ego, maybe.
Yeah, which I find, and everything else has, the reason I'm mentioning this is because I find it interesting that over the years that the students are more sophisticated about authority and rebelling against authority and the whole technology around could have known in the other room and ethics. Stanley Milgram said, we never dreamed we'd get these responses. And yet he replicated that experiment when he saw how upset they were and how in obvious trauma some of them were. But the one thing my students consistently say is we still think that the individual's state of confidence or how sure of themselves they are has something to do with whether or not they will say no to that person playing authority, whether it was Stanley Milgram or one of his researchers. So I thought that was interesting. What do you think?
I don't know. I was going to ask you what you think. I mean, I know what your students think, but I mean, do you think that confidence or ego structure or, you know, executive ego functioning played a role for the people who decided not to go all the way up the shock board?
Well, no, actually, I don't think that, because I think that was the whole point of the experiment, the whole idea of is character something that they could explore? He wasn't exploring character, so how could we say that it was relevant in that experiment? But if we're looking beyond that particular experiment in character structure, because remember, Milgram said, could we all be little Hitlers? I mean, they had said that the Germans, there was something wrong with those German people. That's why they behaved the way they did. That was just part of his personal factors and why he designed the experiment. My students think that character and sense of self has something to do with it, so they must be onto something that, I don't know, it's a social psychology experiment. Best experiments combine everything.
The experiment defines the kinds of questions you can fruitfully ask, and because it is a social psychology experiment, as soon as you ask about ego functioning or confidence, you're step beyond the realms of what social psychology is willing to question. I actually am in agreement with your students that there must be something, there must be some individual character traits that determine this, and it's, as Thomas Blass said, Stanley Milgram sort of thought so too, but the field of social psychology does only looks at the aggregate.
Dr. Blass?
I have no basis for agreeing or disagreeing about the confidence. What I do know is that people do not often realize the power of a concrete situation when they find themselves in the grips of a concrete situation. So in the abstract, maybe they might feel that I have all this great confidence. When they get into the details, the power, the pressure applied to them, I'm not sure. I'm just not sure whether... I'm not ruling out individual differences, but I have no basis for saying yes or no. Milgram himself did not collect any data on confidence.
Okay, we're going to take a call from Karen. Karen is calling us from Boston. Hi, are you
Hello?
There? Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just let you all know that... I saw a film of the Milgram experiment when I was in college, and it completely changed my life. I must say, I was not a psychology major, but I have taken its lesson with me right up to the present day, where I'm teaching English, actually, high school English. And I was teaching the narrative of Frederick Douglass, and noticed that a lot of my students were spacing out and kind of not really believing that slavery could happen today, and that people could inflict pain on one another. And that was just something other people did. So I took a long time to explain the Milgram experiment to them, which absolutely fascinated them. And I'd like to just comment. I'm so glad that you're talking about this today. And I would recommend that people really do, teachers everywhere, examine the lessons and the illuminations that were that came from that experiment, which I think was absolutely brilliant, somewhat flawed. But I would also like to suggest that perhaps the basis of the difference, the 30% who said no, could possibly be a variation in upbringing and teaching. I don't know if Milgram was aware of, kind of Wilhelm Reich and people who thought that the paradigm of the patriarchal family was the most destructive social paradigm of our time. And when I were first hearing that, I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. But if you think about Germany at the time of Hitler, obedience, especially in a family situation, was the most important value taught. And thoughtfulness was certainly not important.
Thanks, Karen.
Actually, I don't think that they found. I think they did look at obedience relationships to their parents. And I don't think that they found that those who were obedient had stricter, more Teutonic type parents than those who weren't. Again, nothing in the personality variables, there's nothing consistent that played out. Your comment about sort of the enlightenment effect of if we teach people about Milgram, will that in fact help people if they get into a situation? Will that in fact help people avoid behaving that kind of way is a fascinating question. I mean, one of the ways that we can look at the experiment is for its pedagogical power. Milgram had quite a few of his participants write in to say, the experiment has changed my life. The experiment has made me aware of the fact that I can't be in a situation of authority without capitulating to it, so I'm going to avoid it. Or even other people saying, now that I know how toxic authority can be, I'm more likely to, in fact, be able to override it and sort of hang on to my own impulses. And whether or not that enlightenment effect is real and how far spread it is isn't really known, but I think that's one way to look at the power of the experiments and one way to see what the positive effects of them may have been.
Dr. Blass, I'm curious, were there any generalizable reactions due to social background, for instance?
Well, Milgram did find, for example, a relationship between educational level and obedience in the direction that you would expect in the first four conditions. But goes on to say is that some of the relationships that were found initially sort of got wiped out later on. So they were not very reliable or consistent. But just having to do with the question of what do we learn from it, and as if you're exposed to it, you learn something from it. And I think I've spoken to people to have, but just on a one large scale example, I spoke to a Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who a military psychologist, who told me something totally astounding. He said when he was training in the early 70s, they showed him training films on how to disobey authority, how to disobey illegal orders, and he attributes that, he calls it a revolution, he attributes that at least partially to Milgram's influence and to Milai.
Dr. Blass. I'm sorry, you know, we're getting to the end of our hour, and I wanted to thank both you, Dr. Thomas Blass, professor of psychology at the University of Maryland in Baltimore, and also Lauren Slater, who joined us in the studio. She's a psychologist and a writer. Her forthcoming book deals in part with Stanley Milgram. It's called Opening Skinner's Box. Dr. Blass also has a book coming out, a biography of Stanley Milgram, called The Man Who Shocked the World. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Dr. Alan Elms, professor emeritus at the University of California in Davis. I'm Alex Beam, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR.
You only have 75 more to go, okay? What's this one?
It's a couple of wavy lines.
Sorry, this isn't your lucky day.
I know. Get a little tired of this.
You volunteered, didn't you? We're paying you, aren't we?
Yeah, but I didn't know you were going to be giving me electric shocks. What are you trying to prove here anyway?
I'm studying the effect of negative reinforcement on ESP ability.
The effect? I'll tell you what the effect is. It's pissing me off.
Well, then maybe my theory is correct.
You can keep the $5 I passed.
I will, mister.